Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning and welcome to For Your Benefit. We're here this morning to have a comprehensive financial planning checkup. Dr. Nick Onder, certified financial planner. Actually, are you a doctor?
On some nights, yes.
Okay, he's not a doctor, but he certainly is a certified financial planner.
Which is a rigorous program in itself, I understand.
Yes, it is. Yes, yeah. It is.
And John Elliott. What can you say about John Elliott? Federal benefit strategist, former seminar presenter, but you will in a pinch, right?
I got one more to do.
Okay.
Scheduled, yes.
And email answerer and knower of things federal, Social Security, TSB, and the like. And I'm Bob Lines. I'm an accountant finance type. And we're here listening to the master lead us through a comprehensive financial plan. So, I mean, we're not going to go out to the stratosphere with this. We're talking whether the person is middle career, whether it's late in a career, whether it's early in the career. The focus here is we need a plan.
Yes, absolutely. And the first thing we want to start with is the budget. And I know I can see you guys already through the radio waves here grinning. We need a budget. We need to figure out what comes in and what goes out. And there's three types of people out there. They're the people that already have this budget down to the penny. And then the other side of the coin, they're people who just don't know where anything goes. They know the big things. They know how much their mortgage is or maybe their car payment. But besides that, they don't have an idea. And then the majority of you who are kind of in the middle that know maybe about 60% of where things go and the other just kind of falls by the wayside. We need a budget. We need to know when things come in and things go out. That's number one.
Which one do we concentrate on, in or out?
In's pretty easy. The out is the big one. And I think that one of the biggest categories people don't realize they spend so much money on is eating out and entertainment. And that's number one. That's the big shocker. Number two to me is that sometimes we see people who have an income of $80,000 and live on a $100,000 a year lifestyle, and that can be tough. And that's one of the hardest things people to do is to bring back their lifestyle. So,
I'm sure you've got a pattern down, but while I'm not a financial planner, I go into it a little bit, not much, but I'd do it the other way. Now, again, I'm a bean counter. So if somebody is in a 25% federal income tax bracket and a 5%, not everybody's in a state with a state bracket, that's 30%. Mm-hmm. So don't look at me like a dog here when I say the next thing is. So if you spend a dollar, you really have to make $1.43.
Right.
If you spend $10, you have to make $143. If you spend $1,000, you have to make $1,430. So in other words, when you look at that and with the discretionary spending, you go, wait a minute, I had to make so much more just so I can spend that. Sorry about that.
I'm going to take a note here. That's a good way of telling clients, hey, if we spend $1,000, we got to make $1,500 on the front end to net us out $1,000. So next time you're looking at that expenditure, think about it in $1,500 terms, not $1,000 terms.
And for those of you all listening, we're talking about discretionary spending. We're not talking about grocery money.
No.
So it like Nick led off with, and I guess we're never going to get a restaurant sponsor, but we're not ever going to get any sponsor, but that is discretionary, and it's in our culture. And we'll go to a moderately priced place or low place. And every now and then, I want to go to someplace really nice. But after you walk out of there and you go and you say, boy, that's a lot. And then if you do this reverse psychology, you go, I don't think I'm going to do that again.
And it's a lot of calories. So you're getting hit twice. You're getting hit in the pocketbook and the gut.
Whoa.
Yes. So if you can. Also, there was I don't know where I read it, but it was very recently or heard it that the myth that fast food is cheapest food you can buy is a myth. If you shop, you can buy a cheaper meal than a McDonald's meal or you name any fast food. Mm-hmm. And, of course, eat better as well. So, yeah, if you can just stay in and just go think of it as a special thing.
And
to
you
save a lot of money.
You deserve to eat out. You deserve to reward yourself. You deserve to relax. But we just got to make sure that we take care of the retirement end before we do that and have it in some sort of moderation. But when we're putting together financial plans and I say to Mr. Client, hey, we got this thing. If we can save an extra $350 a month, and I'm looking at their budget and I say that means eating out half as much as you eat out now. You spend $700 a month on eating out. If we can spend $350, put the other $350 back in your TSP, we got it. And sometimes that's difficult for people to do.
When you first meet with somebody, do you drill into their necessities first and say, okay, we got to establish a baseline, or do you start at the top and start chopping?
No, the necessities are what we start with. How much does it cost to shelter yourself, feed yourself, medicines, clothe yourself, stuff like that. And then we move on to the necessities. The necessities are done, then we move on to the discretionary spending.
Okay, where do you see people make the biggest, I'll say mistake, I don't want to say anybody makes a mistake, but do they just not look, okay, it's in the checking account, I guess I can do it, and if I don't have it in the checking account, I'll put it on the plastic, although I'm reading the plastic is really being paid down with the economy in the shape that it is. People can't add to it, and they're trying to pay it down.
Also, banks are starting to cut credit lines and being more
selective.
Yeah, selective, good word, on who they give the credit to. Eating out and also cars, that's the second big one, is that generally people drive cars that are outside of what they should be driving. Somebody who should be driving a nice Honda Accord is now driving a Mercedes or a BMW. And keep in mind, anything that you purchase outside a two-year-old Honda Accord or Toyota Camry is consumption. And if we have room for that in the budget, you deserve that. That's great. If we don't, or if we're behind on retirement and you're driving a Mercedes E-Class or what have you, a BMW 5 Series, maybe it's time to trade in that car and go to the Honda Accord. Now, that's a difficult thing for people to do, is to go backwards in terms of lifestyle or automobiles. So automobiles and eating out are the two big ones that I've incurred in my 12 years in the scene.
What about outsized homes, oversized homes? Is that do you see that in your practice?
Yeah, that's third on the list there, the people buying the houses that are too big. Or back 6-7 years ago with the exotic mortgages paying interest only or negative amortization mortgages that came about for a brief period of time there. Housing's on that list too. Absolutely. Third on the list in my experience though.
Mm-hmm. When you deal with people, let's look at somebody younger, late 20s, early 30s, and try to break them of the bad habits early on. maybe they've developed some. Maybe they aren't buying the jazzy cars, but they might travel a lot. And they might, like you say, go out a lot. Clothes aren't what they used to be, but still people like nice clothes.
And, sure.
Do you find I won't say a universal, but do you find a more often than not with the, if you will, the newer folks entering the workforce, the mid to late 20s, early 30s, what mistakes, if you were to say they made, what are their mistakes in spending?
Well, the big one is, as you pointed out at the beginning of the show, is they look at their necessities, they look at discretionary spending, and then they look at how much is left over after that, and then they kind of put that towards their TSP or their retirement plan. What we try to do is do it in reverse. Let's get the necessities done, let's get the retirement done, and then at the end of the day, you have $1,200 to spend any way you want to. As long as you don't go into debt further than that, we're okay. But the big thing is they put off retirement. When somebody's generally in their mid-20s, retirement is not even close to their top of mind. Not even close.
But is there a rule of thumb for every year or two or five that they put off? Let's say somebody just gets out of school. There's a natural, one, you got to pay the student loans back. And two, I roomed with 18 other people. I'd like my own place.
Sure.
I never had a car I wanted, and I need some rock and roll too, and I have to have it now. And some of them don't stop till they're 35. But
right.
But if you can educate them, sometimes I talk about and John mentions this often, the miracle of compounding interest, just interest. You know, this is what it'll be, and they go,
Well, you have that desire when you graduate from college and you're out of your dad's basement and you get an apartment and what have you. I mean, you deserve a lot of those things. You worked hard for those college degrees. You worked hard to get to where you are and earn this income. And a lot of the time you have, let's say that somebody earns a $50,000 a year salary, and they're going from bussing tables and flipping pizzas and burgers, making, let's say, $10,000 for ease of math here. They're making five times more. All I want is 15%. Take 15% of what you earn and put it away, whether that be your TSP, whether that be your Roth, or whether that be a savings account. Just get in the habit of earning 15% or taking 15% and putting it away, and you're going to be in good shape when you retire.
And I've noticed, and I've said this often on this show, in the last few years, I see late 20s, early somethings in the pre-retirement seminars.
Yes.
And I go up to them at the break and I say, listen, this is really none of my business, but you do appear to be younger than the rest of the people here. Why are you going so early? And I mean, almost to the person, they say, I don't want to mess up like the rest of the people have that may be in this room.
Yeah.
And almost to the person.
Yeah. And it's FERS where you see them. And it's so important to get started early in the TSP. Because if you lose that 5 years you spoke about, that can be hundreds of thousands of dollars over a 25, 30-year career difference in your TSP account. So those are smart people, the young people that are coming in, because that's going to be a big chunk of their retirement is that discretionary thrift savings plan.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's wonderful. I see them sneak into the back rows of my seminars every once in a while, and I kind of look at them and, they nod. But that's unbelievable to take the average mid-20-year-old is not retirement educated or is even on their list of things to do. They're more about the lifestyle rather than saving. Absolutely.
Okay. And then if you move up the age, so now maybe mid-30s, late-30s, early-40s, maybe there's a family, maybe there's not, maybe there's a spouse, maybe there's not. Do they awaken at that time, or do they still need a nudge?
They're starting to wake up. The nudge is needed probably about 30% of the time, and then the other 30% of the time, they're scared. They know they're behind, and they need a way of catching up. So that's 60%. And then the rest of the 40%, they're on track. But the 30% that are scared and want action with it, what has driven the fact that they have nothing in retirement, and when I say nothing, I literally mean nothing in retirement, is their lifestyle has gotten to the point where now they can't go back. They have their kids in a school system that they like. The house, unfortunately, like some others, is underwater. They can't get out of it. And they're in a pattern where they can't seem to save an extra $1,000 a month. And we have those conversations, and either we literally revamp everything or keep it the way it is, and you work until you're 90.
Do you try to phase them in? And, $1,000 a month is tough. So, I mean, do you say, okay, let's start with 200 and then we'll go for the next 200 6 months later?
Oh, absolutely. And when you have the result, when the computer program and, your hand calculations, all that stuff say, you need to save an extra $1,000. I mean, there's no way that 90% of people can do that. So we ease them in, say, okay, how are we going to do this? How are we going to do that? And sometimes that plan, we just did a plan like that about 3 months ago where literally we needed $1,400 more, and the plan went over a 3-year period, going from zero to $1,400. Now, some of that was we had kids out of private daycare, what have you. Those chunks would be gone, what have you. Car payment would be done in 2 years. So that kind of added to it. But we've had a plan, about It took 3 years to get from zero to where we needed to be. Sure.
All right. Now, when do people get, I won't say sticker shock from what it's going to cost them to do it, but sticker shock that they all have to provide that kind of cash flow. And they go, I just can't do that. And then they walk out. Or they go, well, can I do it a little less? I mean, what's the reaction? Let's get away from all this. And John and I are coming to see you.
Uh-huh. All right.
And we're friends.
Okay.
And we're both in the same situation. And what do you want to be, John? Mid-career, beginning career?
I'll be beginning career.
All okay. Right.
And so I'll be being good. We met.
We're both new guys.
Yeah, we're new guys.
Eligible bachelors.
Yeah.
All right. So we come in, we sit down, and we talk about how much you're earning, what you need to survive. You got the apartment, you got the car, stuff like that. And then we talk about the discretionary spending. And we also talk about what type of retirement you would like to have and what age you would like to retire. And that's a big one, because if people want to retire at 60 and can't do that, one of the options we have is extending the retirement date to your 65 or 70, or trimming back the lifestyle that you want in retirement. Let's say you wanted an extravagant lifestyle. You needed a house here in Washington D.C., a house at the beach, and a house at the mountains. You know, maybe we can keep our 65-year-old retirement date and just have one home instead of three.
Now, John grew up in the Midwest, so he's well-grounded. Mm-hmm. I grew up around here, so I have to keep up with the neighbors. How are you going to break me of my habits?
Some reality checks of, you know, if you keep what you're doing now, you got to work into your 90. It's just not going to work. So keeping up with the Joneses, especially on the car side of things, that's especially with the young guys out there. For some reason, the cars are a big deal.
Well, of course.
Absolutely. And they were with me as well. I'm not innocent on that fact at all.
I'm a gearhead from Wheaton. I understand that. So
that's right.
Yeah, but I never was a car person, but I did finally in my 50s get a BMW.
All right.
And I am now at least a semi-car person, and I probably would never be willing to go back to a cheaper car, because I've seen how BMW performs.
Yes.
But the point is that I waited till my 50s when I could comfortably afford it.
You did it right.
And I was already retired when I bought it, actually.
But you did it right. You got to the point where you could easily afford it, and you went out and bought it. Absolutely. You are in the minority by far. People leasing a car was brought about for somebody who wants to drive a Mercedes that can't drive a Mercedes, so they just figured out, let's just rent it to them.
Yeah.
Leasing a car, as Bob, as you know, sometimes can make tax
only
sense.
If it's primarily business.
Right.
Yeah.
99% of cars leased are not primary business. And let me tell you, that's fine as long as you realize what it is. It's consumption. And if you can afford that consumption, that's fine. But if you can't, and you should be, instead of spending $400 a month to lease a Mercedes, you want to spend $350 a month to own a Honda. I mean, that's better math.
I'm not a financial planner, never want to be a financial planner, because I have a hard enough time keeping up with the tax law, but I understand it. So somebody will come in, like you say, like this, and I'll go to the ballpark estimate. Say, Bob, you're freaking crazy. But I go to that. Now, why do I like that? Because I just plug in a few things. I don't have to spend forever. And then it's got this chart, and they meet in the middle, and then this red light goes off. And I said, you want to be there? Right. And you need to go and see somebody, not me.
Right.
And even that might be somebody young. That might be somebody midway through. And oddly enough, it might be somebody at the end, and they go, you know, I just can't stand this anymore, and I want to retire. And basically, I said, listen, you can't.
Yeah.
And if you do, you're just going to have to go back to work. So why retire from something good to go to an unknown?
Yeah, it's particular.
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Do you use graphs and stuff? People see colors. They understand colors better than a bunch of numbers on 15 sheets of paper.
Absolutely. When I've been doing this so long, when I'm having the conversation with somebody, I can, and we start breaking out some of the numbers, I can tell if they're really far behind. And at that point, I try to ease them in, as you mentioned, the sticker shock at the beginning of how much they're going to need to save. I kind of ease them into those pieces. With somebody that is right on the edge and I don't know, we got to talk about what inflation is going to do and what have you. Yes, we use the computer programs all the time. And when they see that red, it really shocks them. They say, well, what happens here? Why is it red when I'm 82? And I said, well, that's when you run out of money. We need to fix that.
And now when you do assumptions, of course, again, it's going to be depending on the person's age. Mm-hmm. But do you assume that they'll work to 65 or 62 just to get the ball rolling, if you will?
Yeah. We assume 62, and then we assume a life expectancy of 100. I know that's far above what normal life expectancy in their now in their 80s is. But it's one thing that I use with my programs is that I want to make sure that we cover the catastrophe. And hopefully everyone out there lives to 100, but the catastrophe is it costs a lot of money to get there. So we use age 62 as a normal retirement date, and then we use age 100 as a date of death.
All right. Are you pushing back now? Because some people will say, you know, gee, I have to work till 70 so I can get the max Social Security. Of course, they can get it earlier than that. Mm-hmm. But Social Security isn't going to provide them full retirement income.
It never was intended to.
I know.
But that's a little bit of a good thing about Social Security is that it's kept old people out of poverty that otherwise would have been in poverty. But it's not enough for retirement for most people. Certainly middle class lifestyles, it's not nearly enough.
And that's a good point. It wasn't designed for that.
It never was.
No, absolutely not. It's to prevent poverty. I mean, designed to do.
After when you're doing this planning, and we're going to go back, you got this great sheet here. When somebody reaches when they should start taking distributions out, do you use a percentage? And I've heard people say 3%. I've heard them say 5%. I was reading in the paper, or one of these magazines this week, and I said 5%. But they were 70. And they were talking about somebody pulling 5% of their nest egg, if you will, out, and then it would take them to some grand old age. 5% is kind of high.
That is high. And 4% and below is where I start to feel comfortable. And obviously your point's well taken. If you have somebody who's 90 taking 5%, we're going to be okay. Yeah. But somebody who's in their 60s taking 5%, statistically, we're in the low 80s of making it. 4% or below is my comfort level there. Anything under 3%, we're in pretty good shape.
Yeah.
But 5%, just make sure we got the time frames right.
Okay. So I like this sheet here. The first one says, pick proper insurance coverage.
Yes. So we want to make sure that when we finish the budget, we know where things are coming in and out. We want to make sure that we're covered for anything that can happen to us. And statistically, the highest probability of something bad happening to us is dying. And we got to make sure that we got a proper will and estate plan when you do die. And unfortunately, I see this is the number one thing I don't see people have in check is their estate plan. When they die, what happens to your assets? And just to give you an idea, when somebody passes, the beneficiaries on all their investments receive the money. So if somebody has a TSP, the beneficiary, whatever that person says, receives that money. Also, maybe you have some IRAs at the banks or a CD that has a transfer on death or TOD. That person would receive that money.
Yeah. Is it fair to say that a younger person with young children is the best person to have term insurance because they haven't had enough time, longevity, to build up other investments? So term insurance is the cheapest form of insurance. It only pays a death benefit to your designated beneficiary, but at least it provides at a fairly reasonable cost insurance against your premature death, and you don't want your spouse to have to sell the house. And you'd like to have money for your kids' education and maybe some other things.
Absolutely. Term insurance for somebody who's young and living on a budget is going to be a better choice than a whole life product. It has more cost to it. But I'd like to defer that question until we get to the life insurance and just step back with the will and estate plan. So you have your beneficiaries, that stuff goes to whoever you choose. And then anything that's owned jointly, you might own a car with your brother or your dad or what have you, whoever's owned jointly, that's going to go. Everything else goes to probate. And in probate, you have a judge who's going to decide where all that stuff goes. And the judge needs a will to make your wishes known. If you don't have a will, the judge is going to decide where those things go, depending on what state you die in. And John brought up a good point about the kids. Those who are that have kids and don't have a will, the will dictates who has custodianship of the children. And we had a case in the colleague's office where, unfortunately, both parents died simultaneously, and there was a huge custody battle over the kids. Now, the parents had a $2 million life insurance policy. So what do you think the fight was over? The kids?
Oh, of course.
Yeah. Get a will. My rule of thumb is if you have a net worth of under $1 million, you can do your own estate plan documents yourself. Get a computer program to help you out on that. If you have a net worth over $1 million, it's time to hire a professional estate plan attorney.
Okay. Let me do this. For those of you listening, and it's about a little after 10:30 a.m., October 3rd, 2011. We are live for another 25 minutes or so. Give us a call, 202-465-3080, 202-465-3080. If you're listening to us after 10:58, October 3rd, 2011, don't call. We won't be here. But you can email us, and you can email us at 4FOR, your, Y-O-U-R, benefit, at NITPINC.com for your benefit at NITPINC.com. Anyway, sorry to go off, but I mean, some people might want to call up and take advantage of a financial planner and a federal benefits whiz and a bean counter. All righty, so I've now brought my cards and I said, okay, Nick, I better go have a will done, or maybe I'm lucky enough to have to, after your comment, to have a will done.
Yeah.
Or I'm going to try to do it myself if I don't have assets over X. And then what else? Do I need life insurance? Should I be buying life insurance at a young age? Should I be buying life insurance at an old age? Should I be buying life insurance at a medium age?
Life insurance is wonderful to people that need it. The big thing about life insurance, why it gets, you know, some negative connotation with it, is because the commissions are high when you sell it. And I sell life insurance as part of my practice as well. And we have this big future, you know, this calculation program at the office that tells you how much life insurance you need and prints you out this nice fancy brochure. What it basically does is just role play the fact, if you die, is there anybody that is going to be negatively affected by that? With the younger folks, if you're the primary breadwinner in the family and you die and you have a spouse and children at home and you don't have enough money that they'll be okay, yes, you need life insurance. Absolutely. Life insurance comes in two formats. Basically, you have a term insurance and you have your whole life insurance. And term is exactly what it sounds like. You get life insurance for a stated period of time. Let's say 20 years.
Is that renting insurance?
Yes. You are renting insurance. My plan calls for me to have a 20-year term policy. And to give you an idea, let's say it's $100 a month, and a whole life policy is $200 a month. And I'm explaining this to my wife about a couple months ago, and I said, you know, here's what we're going to do. We're going to pay $100 a month for life insurance for 20 years. And then it will end. And she says, let me get this right. We're going to pay $100 a month, and in 20 years, we get nothing out of it. And I said, I really hope that's the case. So she's doing a brake job on my car in about 19 and a half years. I'm not going to drive it. But
well, we have auto insurance, and we don't sit around wishing we'd have an accident. So all these premiums we paid out, we get some money back. So it's the same with the so-called term insurance or long-term care insurance, as a matter of fact.
Absolutely. I mean, it's term insurance is right if it's not a permanent need. If it is a permanent need, let's say that I had a special needs child and needed to make sure that there was life insurance there when I passed that she would be okay. Well, I need to go whole life. Or for those who are looking at whether to take the survivorship benefit or not, and life insurance plays a role in that, and buy life insurance policy instead, well, that needs to be whole life because we don't know the date of death of the spouse. Or for estate planning purposes, if we're looking at life insurance outside the estate and islet for estate planning purposes, well, those are whole life policies as well. I do have a handful of clients that have fortunate enough income and spending habits that we have excess income. We use whole life policies in terms of retirement plans for them. But that's later on down the list. That's about fourth or fifth on the list of what whole life insurance I've seen the uses for.
Do you find somebody that might buy, if they have the ability to do it, whole life, which, as you mentioned, was a higher cost, but mm-hmm. that higher cost in concept goes into a savings account that's,
yes.
If you will, tax sheltered. You shouldn't do things just because things are tax shelters, but eventually it supposedly pays for itself and the like, but it's an estate generator. For
yes.
somebody as they age, they might consider it. I'm not trying to sell it, but they might consider it because it's a way to push assets over to a underneath another cover.
Yes, it is. And once we've maxed out all of our other saving vehicles, that would be your TSP. If you have a spouse, their retirement plan. If they're federally employed, TSP. If they're not, their 401k. Also, if you have children, we're all set with their 529 plans. At that point, we would start looking at a whole life policy as a savings vehicle. And they're wonderful for that. It's just sometimes when I see a whole life policy placed and somebody not maxing out their TSP first, sometimes that was placed for more of a commission sale rather than what's right for the client.
Right.
So, but I'm not boohooing whole life policies. I don't want the phones to ring off the hook. They're wonderful things. We just got to make sure we have everything else covered before we get to that point.
All right, you had some other insurances here.
Yes.
Disability insurance. I just from my take,
right?
I talk to people and, I got disability coverage, $500 a month. And I go, well, I think you need a little more than that.
With the younger people out there, your greatest asset is your ability to work. A lot of people don't realize that. I don't got much in my TSP and all that other stuff. My ability to work is the big thing. And people kind of think, well, I got this life insurance. Well, you got to be dead to collect that. So, if you're having a heart attack and your wife realizes you're going to make it and you're going to be disabled, she's got to get you to the roof and throw you off to collect the life insurance, put a ladder on top of you. That's not going to work. What we do is we go back to that budget and we say, hey, Bob, I noticed that it cost you $2,500 a month to clothe yourself, feed yourself, and support your family. We got to make sure that if you became disabled, we have that money coming in. And it's also got to be tax-free. Because if we got $2,500 a month coming in taxable, that's not going to work. So I want you to talk to your HR department and figure out if you became disabled, how much money would you get? What is it taxable or tax-free, and for how long?
Well, the federal disability in retirement is taxable. Just like your other annuity, it's taxable income. So let's answer that question, get that out of the way.
Mm-hmm. And then Social Security could play a part in that as well. That's also taxable. So we want to make sure if you became disabled that you have enough to support yourself and your family. And if the answer is no, then we should go out there and buy a supplemental disability policy. And the nice thing is with most federal employees, we're at A classification jobs. We, work at desk and what have you. You're not climbing trees or doing manual labor, what have you. So it's not as expensive as somebody who works in, tree trimming, for an example.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's not our audience anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so disability umbrella. You hear this term umbrella policy, and that's kind of like it would cover you under bad conditions? I mean, what does an umbrella policy do, and is it expensive?
Well, an umbrella, I mean, it's a slang term. Imagine pulling up an umbrella and you have all your belongings under it. It basically is a policy that comes into effect after your car policy and sometimes your homeowner's policy payout. So let's paint an awful picture. You go out here and you hit two attorneys in a car and you're sued for $1 million. And the judge says, that's right, you owe their families $1 million. And you say, well, judge, I got $100,000 on my car insurance, and my homeowner's policy actually going to pay out another $200,000, so I got $300,000. Only thing I have left is my TSP, the equity in my house, and my checking accounts, and my future earnings. And you don't want that stuff, do you? What do you think the judge is going to say?
Yeah, that's nice. How much are they?
Yes, because that's what we're going to take. An umbrella liability policy is a third policy that you put into place after your homeowner's and your car payout. Then you have an additional $1 million under an umbrella that will pay out after that. The nice thing about this is it's cheap, $250 or $300 a year. And the reason why no one hears about this is because the commission behind selling an umbrella liability policy is enough to buy that person maybe a snack or a lunch. They won't talk about that whole life policy. But that umbrella policy is a big thing. And we want to cover up to net worth. So if you have a net worth of $1.1 million, we got to go to $2 million. They're sold in million-dollar blocks. The other big thing on this that I want to make sure everyone realizes is that insurance companies separate business and pleasure. So, Bob, if I'm coming over to your house for a cocktail party, I'm injured, that's on the personal side. Okay, that's going to be covered by your umbrella. Let's say I come over to drop off some tax returns or what have you, and I'm injured. Okay, well, that's on business. So for those who are out there doing some consulting or having people over to the home or outside of the work environment, make sure that you have an umbrella policy that's going to cover both. Sometimes insurance policies will be okay with covering both. Sometimes they want a completely separate policy just to make sure you got business and pleasure covered. That's important.
That's very important. I did not think of that. Hmm. I don't see too many people in the home, but yeah. People will drop stuff off.
Sure. Sure. So they keep a big line there.
Okay, long-term care. When should I get interested in that? And John is a maven on that. I'm sure you are too.
Well, I have even some personal experience with my mother-in-law and lack of long-term care insurance. I'm getting to an age, a lot of this stuff I'm actually living myself. Long-term care, at least through my mother-in-law, I am living, and she couldn't get it, but she could have years ago before she got ill, but now she's in long-term care.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, they won't sell you long-term care insurance. But that was a driving force for my wife and I both to get individual long-term care policies, because we don't want to put our kids in the position of, how's my dad or mother going to be taken care of if they have to go in a nursing home or if they have to have pretty much round the clock in home care, which is the trend, I understand, is to try to keep you in your homes. But still, that can get very expensive if you need 24/7 care in your home even. And that's essentially what my mother-in-law is getting. So the question is she going to outlive her assets? So she's paying out of pocket. Mm-hmm. That is money that would ordinarily go to my wife, her daughter, that she's not going to get. We don't need it, but then if she runs out of money and still is living, then it's Medicaid.
Yep.
And that can not always get you really good care, or and it doesn't get you oftentimes in a situation that you don't want you to be in, or you don't want your mother or father to be in.
Right. At that point, you lose control. You're
right.
Now the state is taking care of you.
You have to be broke, basically.
You have to be at the point of poverty. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So let me just digress a little bit. And the reason it's on my checklist is not to say everybody needs a long-term care policy. It's on the checklist to say we got a 50% chance we're going to need long-term care. How are we going to pay for it? And let's take two extreme examples. Let's say somebody got a gazillion dollars And 4%, they're taking a 4% withdrawal a year. So that's 4% of gazillion dollars. They have enough money to self-insure at that point. So there's a point where you have enough money that you just self-insure for those assets. Or they buy a long-term care policy, just as John pointed out, to protect the inheritance for the next generation.
Yeah, a lot of people don't want to see their assets handed over to a nursing home.
Right.
They'd rather hand it, even if they don't have heirs, they'd get much more satisfaction if they knew their assets were going to their favorite charity. But
absolutely,
it's pretty galling to consent. Now, if that doesn't bother you, you know, if you don't either have children or heirs, and certainly if you're not married and you're supporting a spouse, long-term care insurance isn't for every individual.
Mm-hmm.
But you've got to look at your own situation and see, what your goals and desires are. It's a financial planning tool to protect your assets, I guess, is the way.
That's what it is.
Yeah.
It protects assets. A lot of people don't realize that. I think long-term care is for me. No, it's actually to protect the estate. And we have some children who buy it for their parents to protect the inheritance. I know it sounds horrible, but that's there.
Well, that's smart. Yeah.
And then also we have clients who their parents are a prime candidate for it, but they can't afford it. The kids buy it because they know that it's going to be their responsibility to take care of their parents, and they want an insurance policy in place there. So there's multi-uses of that. So we got the rich guy who now he can self-insure. Now we got the other side of the table, those who don't have the assets to protect and are not close to the poverty level, but don't have a gazillion dollars. Now, they might not buy a long-term care policy because there's not much there to protect. Now, they would buy a policy to have the control for stay at home or not being able to be, if they live in Rockville and the state's taking care of them, they might ship them out to Frostburg, Maryland or what have you to be, there's an open bed out there. They want the control. The sweet spot is the people who are in the middle, who don't have enough to self-insure but have an estate that they want to pass. And the first thing we do is we look at the age. In my opinion, we need to start looking at long-term care at age 50 and make a decision before you're 55. That's ideal. It can still make sense in your 60s. In your 70s, I've seen it placed. I don't think it makes sense to buy it in your 70s, but
because it gets too expensive as you age, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Mid-50s is a good combination of it's still very affordable, and also we know more about your financial situation at that point, how much you have. If you had inheritances, we have a more defined view of it.
What if you're in your 20s and you ride a motorcycle or a horse? would you be a candidate for long-term care insurance?
My view is no. I look at the disability side of things. I would have a very nice disability policy. Long-term care, I've seen people buy it in their 20s and 30s. I would disagree with
that.
It's
dirt cheap, but then you're paying the premiums a much longer time.
Right. And also, we have no idea of what you're going to look like when you're 55 years old in terms of your assets. So,
okay. We've got our basics covered, and you're guiding us through, and maybe I'm of modest means now. Where do we go next? I should have some kind of cash accumulated somewhere in case of an emergency.
Absolutely. 3 to 4 times monthly expenses is what we need to have in cash. So we go back to that budget. Let's say you're spending $5,000 a month to make the math easy. Well, 3 to 4 times, that's $15,000 to $20,000 in cash. That's a big one. And through the seminars and years teaching for you guys, it's literally one extreme or the other. We have some clients who have $100,000 in their checking account, and we have people that have almost nothing in there. But 3 to 4 times monthly expenses is fundamentally what we should have in there.
Okay, once we've got that covered, where do we go?
All right, now we got to start getting a little bit more interest. And let me define the 3 to 4 times monthly expenses. I want it in a place that is FDIC insured and never goes down in value. So we've had some clients be creative about it. Say, Nick, I need $20,000. What I did is I bought a 1-year CD that's breakable at no cost at any time. Okay, that works. Never goes down in value and is FDIC insured. Sure. After that, we got to start looking at some better interest. Now, whether that's U.S. government bonds, whether that's tax-free municipal bonds, whether that's a conservative equity portfolio, whether that's an aggressive equity portfolio, we got to start placing this money elsewhere. And it helps you psychologically invest correctly, because if you're very young and your portfolio calls for 80% stocks, 20% bonds, but you don't feel comfortable with that fluctuation, it's because you don't have any emergency account. You know, your hot water heater goes, we don't have money to fix that. It helps people psychologically put their money where it should be, because they know if an emergency happens, they need a new roof, they need $10,000, we got that. We have a plan.
Okay. A lot of people that we deal with in the seminars are very cautious.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people say, well, they're conservative. Let's just call it cautious. How do you convince that person or have them see that if you stay in a low interest bearing account for every percent or two or three that they might gain from going outside of that protective shell,
mm-hmm,
over a period of time, it's staggering.
Yes.
But how do you do that? Because you got a psychological issue here.
Oh, absolutely.
And I'll be able to do this, but they ignore inflation over 20, 30, 40 years.
Oh, inflation is ignored 80% of the time.
Yeah. And somebody's going to call up or about to call up and answer, what inflation? But, you know, things shall pass.
We can play a tape from the show back in the 80s and we'll talk about it.
Yeah.
My job is battling emotion. I mean, managing money is the easiest thing I do. Helping clients deal with their emotion is 80% of my job. That's what we do. And, you know, it's always a battle between logic and the textbook. And what we do is we help break it out into time frames. We say, let's say, Bob, you're a nervous investor or cautious investor, as you pointed out. And we say, okay, well, let's look at, if we had a need for money, how would that work? Right. First, we have your walking around money in your checking account. Let's say we've exhausted that. Now we have your emergency account with 3 to 4 times monthly expenses. Okay, we've exhausted that. Then we have a portfolio of some solid tax-free bonds. Okay, well, let's say we run through that. And then we have your TSP. If we get to your TSP, this is going to be a catastrophe. You can see how we have all these steps before we need the TSP. And let's say your situation was fortunate enough that the TSP wasn't even needed in retirement. So now we have a TSP that's not going to be needed for 20 or 30 years, and a good plan of how to get money before we touch that. We try to create time frames, is what I'm getting at. How long do we have the money? If we need the money in the next 2 or 3 years, we have no business in the stock market. If it's 20 to 30 years, a strong majority should be in the stock
market.
What's
the bend point? Is it if you need the money in 5 years?
5 years, we're starting to, just to give you some statistics, on 5-year period, if we use the C fund or the S&P 500, and we take every rolling 5-year period, there's about a 90% chance that if you invest the money in there, it would be positive. Okay. A 1-year rolling period in the TSP is about a 74% chance to be positive.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? In 15 years, it's 100% positive.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so at that point, at 5 years and above, we start blending in equities into the portfolio.
Okay. Say you're retired and you haven't touched your IRAs or TSP or whatever investments you have. Is there a rule of thumb as to what is a good mix between bonds and stocks?
No, because it has to do with how the time frames. And we have some very fortunate retirees that are never going to need their TSPs.
So they could be more
equity-based at that point.
Equity-based, right.
So they're 80% stocks, 20% bonds.
So if they're only going to have to take minimum distributions at 70.5 and let the rest continue to be invested, they could be a little heavier into stocks, is, I guess, what you're saying.
Absolutely, because I know this sounds crazy, but that asset's really not managed for them. It's managed for their kids.
Yeah.
Or in some cases, even the grandkids. We skip that generation if we can do it in the estate plan. So we have time on that. Time equals equities on that. And then we have some retirees that are very close on the budgets, and we need to make sure that the volatility in their accounts are down and safety's there. More safety, less volatility equals more bonds. So we're almost at the opposite. And the most conservative portfolio that we can create outside of the G fund is a 75% bond, 25% stock portfolio. Helps with the volatility. Stocks and bonds offset themselves.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay. So we started at the beginning, mm-hmm. and we laid the, if you will, the ground rules. This is what we need. And then we might put some trappings on it for uncertainties, life insurance. And then we worked our way through another few years, number of years. Now we got some more income, but there might be kids. Everybody ain't going to have kids. And so when did they start to cross the finish line? We have about a minute and a half left, and the kids are now grown. Do you find some of the people still want to take care of them, even though they're grown and they do everything for the kids when they're gone? Or do they say, no, it's time for me to enjoy what I've built up?
Wow. It's almost a 50-50 split. As you're formulating the question here, I'm trying to do the math in my head. For people who are, say, hey, gravy train's over, you guys are on your own, to people who tend to give a little bit more. I would tell you, and as my observation, the parents who tend to continue to give their kids a little bit more, tend to be less motivated than those who have been cut off from the gravy train. That's my two cents on the
phone. Okay, we got 1 minute. We just lost three quarters of the listeners with that. That was it. although they should listen. How does one contact you, Nick?
A good phone number for me is area code 301-941-1300. So it's Nick Onder, ONDER, 301-941-1300, and I'm in Chevy Chase, Maryland. And if you call that number, Sue and Geraldine either will answer the phone. They're wonderful people and love to say hello to you. So thank you for having me.
Okay, Nick, thanks for being here. I'm going to go jump off the roof with John. John, final words?
Yeah, I've said it before, but it bears repeating. Check out the TSP calculator, tsp.gov. It's a real education in how your money grows and what your options are in retirement.
Okay, great. Thanks. And next week, we're going to be a can show because it's a holiday, but it's going to be the Thrift Director and Tom Trabucco. And it was a great show on the Roth TSP. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.